Hey, welcome to another episode of the Low Code Podcast. Today we have Mark Magnusson with us. He's the founder of Builder, which is a low code tool that allows you to build software, I would say custom, very complex software using a visual interface. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So tell us, I know if you haven't heard about Builder, it has a pretty cool story because Builder, which is this platform that Mark has worked on for such a long time, is built with Builder. So let's start there. How do you build a no-code, low-code tool with itself?
Yeah. So in general, most of the tools that are out on the market, including Builder, are effectively generating and translating JSON and other types of code. And so when we first set out to rebuild our internal tools to become Builder, just a little bit of backstory there. Builder is actually, as a tool, been around for a very, very long time. It was just only used internally at our agency for like 15 years. When we decided to turn it into a product, we decided to build it with itself, which was pretty difficult to do because we literally did not want to build it with the old version. We wanted to build it with the version that's not built yet, which is sort of impossible to do. It's a chicken and egg problem. So the way we did it was we wrote code to do the execution of the environment first. So we wrote a little bit of code that would interpret JSON and translate it into pages and executing code and things like that. And then we set about manually writing some of that JSON to first form some of the first pages and elements and actions and things of the studio itself. And as we built, say we built a page, like we built the studio page, which is like an infinite canvas, and we wrote a whole bunch of JSON manually, effectively, the execution environment would run that JSON schema as an application. And then that application allows us to create more of that JSON. So it took us a while to start from having none of the schema in place, but now we're at a spot where we literally use the tool to just build the tool. And we use the exact same setup. We use the data collections, the filtering, the actions, the elements. If we need something custom, we do that custom work in the exact same way that someone would add code to their project in Builder. We add code to our project in Builder. It was a complex process to get started, but I'm really glad we did it that way because we really do sort of like inform ourselves of what it feels like to be a customer of the tool.
Yeah, which is unusual with no-code tools. Usually it's developers building the tool, but they don't really know how the tool ends up being used by no-coders. So about the studio, you started as a studio and then you built Builder along the way. What types of projects were you building at the studio?
Yeah, so we started in 2006, so it was a very long time ago. You know, SaaS was not really a term out in the world. We were selling, at the time, just heavy custom software. We would go and basically build hard code, whatever we wanted, or whatever a customer wanted. And then when we formed the agency around that, we did a couple of projects where we just like got some income out of it. And then we said, you know, maybe we should make this platform that's in our heads. And what we did was we basically limited the scope of what projects we could take to very small projects. At the time, it was basically CRM type stuff. It was calendars, and contacts, and things like that. No relationships between the collections or anything like that. Just very, very simple. And we would go sell that to small businesses. So we would go into a small business. We would basically pitch them on this idea of, we can build a totally custom setup for organizing all of your contacts and all of your calendars and everything in your business. So the first types of businesses we went after were services-based companies. So people who would sell a product at retail and then also go install that. So a lot around the home industry, like floor covering and lighting. And
what were they using back then? Access?
Or Access all paper. It's like,
yeah, okay.
Big paper calendar on the desk and, you know, or a whiteboard calendar kind of thing.
Right.
And then just literally Rolodexes. You know, our hardest problem back then was convincing people that it was okay to have your data stored on our server. You know,
right.
That was just a foreign concept in 2006, which is really weird to think about now that people were concerned with that. But it really was a a point of contention. Like, we had to make sure we could get over that hurdle before we went any further, because we found pretty quick if the owners of these businesses didn't trust it, they were never going to close as a customer. So we might as well just, quit the process. So we did that. And what would happen is every one of these customers would end up saying, you know, can we do this instead? And can we do that instead? And it just needed more things in the platform, right?
So originally you were selling them a product, a pre-built product, and then you started doing custom, or it was always custom?
It was always custom, and it was always using the tools. So basically at that point, you can kind of think of it like, you can actually visualize, it's a pretty simple visualization. It was just a set of tabs at the top, so two tabs, contacts and calendars, and then underneath each of those was another set of tabs for the calendars that you've created and the contact lists you've created. So you would go in and create a contact list, you would add a bunch of fields to it, and then you would start populating records. And we, over time, as people just asked for more types of fields where they could add more customization in, we would add in things like, you know, date type fields and calculation fields and relationship fields between things. So it was like a really early rudimentary version of like an Airtable today, right?
Okay.
Like that's what people wanted, right? People needed that same type of organization, and they didn't have a way to do it really. There were some tools on the market, but they were typically either expensive or required some kind of like onboarding process with a developer of some sort. And they were usually locally hosted. So one of the selling points for us was you can get online at home and open up your contacts and answer the question that your customer is asking, which was like really novel for these small businesses back then. Nobody could really allow them to do that easily. They were still doing things like literally point to point, you know, tunneling of internet so that it was secure and all that kind of stuff. It was just wild back then how much money was spent on all that infrastructure.
Yes.
So as people added or requested more things, you know, eventually had like custom forms where you drag and drop and make a form that's tied to that data backend. And then, you know, they want things like really complex calculations and APIs. And so we just kept leveling that up. And after 7 or 8 years of doing that, the platform was pretty robust. I think we'd already rewritten it from scratch by that point, at least once, maybe twice, after about 8 years. And so it was...
Did you have a lot of clients back then? Was the goal always to build the product as Builder is today, or the goal was the agency and the recurring model?
It was kind of both, to be honest. We weren't really sure at the time. When we first started, I went and pitched before we actually had it out and had customers out. I went and pitched VCs in 2006 and literally just got laughed at a couple times. Like, no, nobody's going to want to do this kind of thing, you know? And so we just decided to do it on our own. So the agency side was out of necessity, but it also allowed us to really understand our customer. And some of it was, you know, we come in and set up your CRM system basically for you, but then we train someone on your staff on how to maintain it and how to add to it and how to change it, right? And so it was a little bit of both going on back then. As that transitioned into bigger and bigger clients, it became more and more like a traditional agency model for those really large clients, because they were really coming to us specifically because they didn't want to have a development arm of their business. They didn't want to hire programmers and deal with all that. So we became that tech side for a lot of companies.
And back then, were these companies aware of the tech stack that you were providing? Especially larger companies are looking for a specific, like, I want my app to be built in this tech stack. And you were not using, let's say, a traditional tech stack. Was that a selling point, or was that a hurdle in the sales process?
Yeah, so early on, the smaller customers, they didn't even know how to ask those questions, right? It wasn't even a concern. But as we got to larger customers, they definitely were asking those questions, right? They were asking, and we did lose deals because we're not on whatever framework. Or, you know, if they already had like an internal team of developers and they were looking to supplement that team, that was usually a bad fit for us. You almost always get into the C-suite discussions and the CTO would come in and shut it down because number one, it threatened their fiefdom internally. Right. But also it's just an unknown, you know, they don't know us. That we're a small business. They don't trust us to do that. And what happens if we go out of business and they can't maintain it because it's this custom thing? So we basically avoided those kind of clients. We would go after the clients that were sort of like mid-market clients, maybe lower mid-market. Like a $1 billion company would be extremely large. Like those are the largest customers that we ever had. Anything bigger than that, and they basically already had systems in place that were not going to be, that were basically detrimental to our sales process. But the ones that were really, really successful were that like 100 million plus company who had just gotten to the size that they really needed to build something fully custom. But they didn't have, you know, SAP level money to spend. They weren't going to go spend 30 million on their custom software. And there were some really good clients that we got out of that, and it really pushed the platform forward. So we were really well primed for whenever no code kind of became a thing. We weren't.
Did you start to lose the smaller clients in order to take the bigger ones, or were you just increasing your staff and keeping the small, older clients, but at the same time taking these way larger clients?
Yeah, it's kind of wild. I mean, most of those customers required no maintenance, right? And they were fairly low dollars, right? We're in like the hundreds or low thousands of dollars per month. So it's very much a SaaS model on those. It's like come in, do some training and some services, but then it's pretty much, you know, you're paying your $300 a month and you can customize it and continue to do that. So it was very low touch. We really didn't have much required of us once a customer got up and running. And we still have clients from 12 or 13 years ago in the agency. Like these are two separate businesses, by the way. Like Builder is a totally separate company now. But in the agency, some of these, they're small businesses that just, it works. So they're just going to keep doing it, you know? So a lot of, most of it was low touch. You get them set up and they would just keep going. What did happen was we stopped selling to those types of clients, right? As we got bigger and bigger clients, the business just wasn't set up anymore for like these small one-off things. It really became set up for these large clients. So it transitioned in terms of who we were selling to, but because of the lack of support need, because the tool was like super, super simple back then, it just didn't require anything.
And these companies, are they using the Builder of today, or they got, they have like a previous version?
We have both, right? So some of them like literally just never wanted to change. They just, and we, for the most part, don't force change. Sometimes we will, like obviously if there's security issues or, you know, we've sunsetted the old versions and stuff. Like, you know, the people who are customers from 12 years ago are not on 12-year-old code. But they're not necessarily on the current Builder product yet. Some of them we're transitioning and we're actively going after doing that, but a lot of them it's like not even worth the time for either of us. You might as well just like let it go, you know, just let them keep running on it, and it doesn't cost anybody anything, so just keep going.
I think that you have like a pretty unique setup of how you started, and you even have the agency today that has allowed you to grow Builder into the product that you want. And it's not based on what the VC fund wants. It's not about, like, you build a product yourself. You don't have a lot of pressure. Is that still the case? Have you got money invested into the product, into Builder by VC funds? Or do you still manage the roadmap of the product today completely?
I mean, we will always dictate the roadmap. But yeah, so we did a small raise over the last year or so. But it was all friends and family. There is one venture capital firm in it. Hustle Fund is in it. But that was more of a partnership thing. We partnered with them to help them launch their NFT collection last year. They were looking for someone. I can't remember exactly how that connection was made. But they needed someone to spin up a mint site for them. And so we got on a call with them and talked to them. And we were like, you know what, this sounds like it'd be worthwhile for us to do and for you to do. Let's try it out. So that was really where that came from. It wasn't like a pitch process. It was more, I mean, we did pitch eventually, but it was primarily just like we partnered, it worked well, and, you know, we all liked each other. But outside of that, there are no venture capitalists in our rounds at all. It's all friends and family and some customers who came in too. So I'm hoping to keep it that way for the time being until we see some real growth. Like I want to see a real flywheel. And then I want to throw money at a growth curve that I can, where we stay in control of it. Because I do think it is important what you said there, you know, from a like philosophical perspective, we're very much lean towards like the calm company way of doing things.
That's how I feel. Yeah.
You know, we prefer that method. But if we've got a growth engine that makes a lot of sense to throw a lot of money at, that's a good time to put a lot of money behind something and not putting that out of the picture. We definitely want that to be the case and we're working towards that. But we won't do it prematurely, right? Like what I don't think we will do, what I doubt you'll see Builder do is go raise an obscene amount of money, just for the headline.
Just because, right.
Or even for the security of it. It also provides a ton of security, you know? You know, but we probably won't go down that path. I always leave doors open, but we probably won't go down that path.
So I think that with the no-code tools like no-code, low-code, I always have like three divisions, like no-code tools, low-code tools, and then low-to-code tools, like the more technical ones. And I've always thought that Builder is there. Is that the case? Would you agree? Like, who is the typical user, the typical client for Builder, and who is Builder not for?
Yeah. I mean, the not for is super easy, right? If you're like super green coming into building anything, Builder is not your tool to start on. Like, it's not a good spot to. That's like saying
to get started.
You know, go from zero to React, you know, without a developer's mindset already. That doesn't really make sense. Like, or even if you're getting,
does that mean that Builder is mainly used by software engineers?
No, I wouldn't say mainly used by software engineers, but more people who have. I think the people who are most successful fall into two camps. One of them is engineers, like software developers, who want the benefits of something like a tool like Builder, where you don't have to spin up environments, you don't have to spend half a day just getting your infrastructure in place to be able to start building. You just go into Builder and start creating, you know. That's a huge win for a lot of developers who are used to, you know, 800 dependencies and a bunch of random errors while they're setting it up and all that stuff. That's a really successful camp of users who come in. And then people who have either like been around product or been around development. So then I kind of fall into that camp. I don't code, but I understand it enough. Like I can read the code, kind of understand what it's trying to do. Couldn't tell you where the bug is, you know, I couldn't fix it, but I can say, I think I understand what that's doing. Right. So there's like that level of person. There's a lot of people like that out in the world who've just been sort of adjacent to it, either, you know, product manager or even like project management level things where you're building stuff. Cause really what it's about more than anything is a logical mindset of problem solving. So I've got this issue. Here are the different ways that I could solve that issue. Which one do I want to go with? Break that out into its pieces and then go attack each one of those. So if you couple that with an understanding of a tool like Builder, where you understand conceptually something like after the record saves, I want to store the ID in a variable for some purpose. Like once you learn concepts like that and you apply those concepts in Builder to that logical mindset of problem solving, that's where the magic really happens. So it doesn't really require any code knowledge, but it does require conceptual
technical mindset,
how it works. Yeah, exactly.
Does that mean that in terms of the roadmap, are you looking to build a more robust technical product rather than bringing it down to the masses in a more no code environment?
I mean, we're honestly just going to keep trying to thread the needle. Right. So we think there's a good middle ground. And we think that there's a lot of ways to do that. One way is with plugins inside of the studio. We're already seeing some of that with some of our power users, actually, just before we even have a plugin system in place, they're actually creating their own plugins that you can install and do things like trace things through the system. And then adding in concepts like, you know, we're working on some modeling techniques for using some of OpenAI's tools to automatically generate things, because we have enough information inside of Builder projects now to where if we model it based on that data, there's no reason you can't say something like, you know, build me a website that acts like this, does these things, and build me an app that does these things. And also something like, and style it like Drew Thomas. Because it knows enough information about all of that. So I think there's a gap that can be closed there where, and it kind of goes philosophically to our goals. We want to make it easier, but we don't want to make it to where we're pretending like the human being doesn't need to understand what they're doing. Right. Which I think is a lot of the no code perception is people come into no code tools and sort of like expect everything to be abstracted away where you're not really having to think hard through it. But almost right. I would argue every single product actually requires a lot of knowledge to build something real. It doesn't really matter which tool or set of tools you're using. You end up with a ridiculous amount of just ingrained knowledge after you've built something. But I think we can thread that needle with AI by generating a large chunk up front. And then that also helps you learn the tool at that point because you have the thing that you thought of already sitting in front of you, which is why, you know, deconstructing project templates and things is such a good way to learn. Same thing, but with your context around it, I think could be huge. Mm-hmm. We feel like people really should and can level up their mindset around how to build if they're interested in building, right? And I think tools like Builder who expose those pieces of it, who don't try to obfuscate all of it, really help people level up. They become coders or programmers without really trying to become programmers, you know, but they really are at the end.
Yes. Yeah, even with no-code tools, what you said is perfect. Like, even with no-code tools, there's logic involved. So when we compare no-code tools to website builders, I always say, with a website builder, you have this drag-and-drop interface, and that's it. So it's simple to use Wix or Squarespace to build something. But even with the simplest no-code tools, there's logic. So it's not only about dragging and dropping a list or a map or something, but then you have to configure that thing to behave the way you want based on the user role, based on the logic. So there's always a little bit of technical knowledge that you must have, even in the most basic no-code tools, in order to get the end result that most people want or need.
Absolutely. And I would take that a step further, too, in going into user experience. I think where a lot of the no-code and even the low-code tools kind of fall down is where they limit the ability of a builder to create a truly unique user experience. If you don't have full access to styling, you don't have full access to, you know, how that table view actually renders the information and all of the interactions with that table view or whatever the element is that you've dropped on the page, you really need full control over it in order to make something unique. And I think it depends on what you're trying to build, right? If what you're trying to build is a simple list app of things, and the goal is to get someone from, you know, not having an understanding of those things to having an understanding of those things, if that's the product you're creating, more informational, then I think it makes perfect sense to use those kind of tools. Get your MVP up, get it out. You know, it's going to look nice without much effort. You know, it's going to get through that process without a ton of effort. But once you're trying to differentiate yourself in a market and you really need to think about user experience, I think that's where a lot of these fall down. And that's really where, that's one of those things where we just don't compromise. You know, we won't build we won't launch ourselves like an element type that restricts your ability to organize the information within that element type. Now users can do that themselves. Like, you can create your own element types and your own action types inside of Builder, and you can share those with other users. So people will do that. But from us at a top level and at like a core level in the infrastructure, our main goal is to make sure that we thread this needle of allow you to have a path to go from, I don't understand how to build software, to I understand enough about Builder to build software without limiting what you can build with it. It's a really hard needle to thread, but we continually try it.
So I have a couple questions. I'll get into the Web3 one first. Builder in the no-code space, no-code, low-code space, was probably the first platform that integrates with the Web3 movement. Mm-hmm. And you actually have an NFT related to the product. Talk to us a little bit more about that. Do you still think, based on how everything has fallen down in the crypto space. Are you still interested in Web3? Do you still see a lot of projects in the Web3 space using Builder? How does that Web3 relate to Builder?
Yeah, I mean, from like a technical perspective and from how we perceive the technology of it, not the, you know, NFT speculative movement. I separate these things logically in my mind. There's this one thing that's like NFT speculation and before that ICO speculation.
Right. Yeah.
There's that. And then there's the decentralized apps and also the concept of users controlling much more of how an app is built, how the thing that they use, the tools that they use get maintained over time. And that side of Web3, like, we're all in. We want that future for the world. You know, that's like, that's conceptually, that's how we want the world to be. On the speculative side, we played in it personally, but Builder as an entity, like, doesn't have anything to do with that really. And a good way to view that is like our NFTs are pure utility. We intentionally didn't attempt to like hype them. We didn't make promises on like, you know, on really anything. It's like, here's an NFT. If you have it, you get our pro features. That's it. You know?
Right.
We do want to launch a token at some point, but it's basically all about, do we have product market fit and do we have enough users for that token to be a true utility token? Because it'll be the same way. If we ever launch a token, it will be a utility token, not a speculative token. And so it'll all have to be tied into an ecosystem. Otherwise it just won't ever happen. We won't do it. To answer your question about people coming to Builder to build projects, it's still every day. People ask in our Discord, you know, I'm trying to set this NFT up. How do I make a contract? How do I interact with this new, you know, chain that popped up? Can I do that? Can I, you know, it's pretty much every day in the Discord. Somebody's asking about something that we've never been asked before in the Web3 space. I don't really see that slowing down to zero. I think that'll be there through this whole bear market that's going on, and it'll pick back up on the other side. And I think it's a good, we kind of see these things as magnets for Builder. Builder is a tool that can kind of do anything on the web. So when we do something like put out a Chrome extension builder or put out the ability to do Web3, or like we're working on a bunch of Shopify integrations right now, we see those things as sort of like magnets that bring you into this Builder ecosystem of, if you learn from any of these directions, you can actually build any of these things with Builder.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
How do you define the roadmap? Because it very much relates to new features. And I think that's a struggle for founders like you of these no code, low code tools. Like, what do we do next? The community might want some things. You might be thinking of something else. How do you decide what feature gets rolled out in the next quarter or year?
Yeah, it's definitely tough because first of all, Builder is just so big as a product. Joke around internally, it's, you know, it's like 30 products in one. You can sort of just like pick a thing and go, that's a product.
Yeah.
You know? And we actually see startups launching that say this is our product, and it's like one feature instead of Builder is that whole product. So it's definitely tough because it's just so broad, you know. But our intent is really to maintain the core and do it in such a way that it makes it easier and easier for more and more people to get into that core. So for instance, like there was one core change we did to actually integrate Web3 stuff. And all it was making it so that you have a signature in the wallet, and that creates a user using our authentication backend. So it's an actual Web2 session created whenever you sign in with your wallet.
Okay.
Other than that, everything else was just custom JavaScript that anyone, any developer on the planet could have written that custom JavaScript in their project. So really the core structure of Builder is already set up in a way. And it's the same thing with the Chrome extensions too. We built one feature that's a communication layer between the browser and a Builder page running in the extension. And everything else is just custom actions. So anyone could go extend upon it. And the Shopify stuff we're doing is the exact same way. It's like these core things we have to do just to do the initial interaction. everything else is just actions that anyone could create or element types anyone could create.
Yeah.
So that's the goal, is like make sure that our base is always accommodating and then let the details get expanded upon by anyone.
Yeah. What are a couple of projects that have been built in Builder that you're like, oh, I have never thought of this, and seeing people build projects in Builder that you didn't envision? Anything that has been surprising or like a wow factor that, wow, this is built in Builder?
I think the most surprising stuff I've seen has been there have been some things where people are just basically, they're not hacking it, but like we expose all of our, how our front end works, you know, like how the core works, it's all exposed. And so we've had developers come in and do things, like coders come in and go, you know what, if I put a page header and I let people copy and paste this page header, I can inject my own stuff into the studio and it all works. Right? Things like that, that are just totally outside of the box. In terms of projects, I mean, we've pretty much seen it all over like 15 years of building custom stuff for people. And that's one of the reasons why we think these tools can exist, is because really like 95% of every app is effectively the same. You know, I've got data, I'm relating it. I've got logic about how things operate. User experience defines a lot more than those features, I think. And then there's some things too that you can do in Builder. Like I can't remember what the game was. I think it was chess. Someone made a game of chess in Builder last year. You know, there's things like that happen where I'm just like, I just didn't expect that at all. I think those will just continue. And there's also some pretty large projects. There's a project where they have like laser engraving, or not laser engraving, like laser cut diagrams, and they have this like massive Facebook following. And they came into Builder and they built out over like a long time. They've been building for a while. I think they're launched now, but it's a massive project. I mean, you know, tens of thousands of records in different collections that are like tying all these things together, and steps and lessons and all this stuff built into it. It's just a really large project. I don't know, probably hundreds and hundreds of pages. So it's really cool to see that kind of stuff when people really go like all in, you know, they're building their full startup on it. So just always awesome to see that.
Does Builder has like, when I'm talking about tools like, I don't know, Bubble of Light, etc., I'm always like, when you build inside of these tools, you're building inside of a box that has certain limits, certain walls. So the tool will get you to a certain point, but maybe there'll be features that you might want down the road that cannot be built in this tool. Is that the same case for Builder? Are you limited based on how Builder is built? Or is it like an extensible solution, more like the low-to-code platforms, like Flutterflow, for example, that if there's something that you cannot do in Flutterflow, then you just use Dart and Flutter to create that code. How does Builder compare to those two different types of no-code tools?
Yes, definitely more on the Flutterflow side of that.
Right.
You can extend it in any way you want, effectively with JavaScript, both on the front end and on serverless functions. You can actually bring in node packages and write custom serverless JavaScript that executes all inside of your project and in its own spun up environment. It's kind of wild how detailed that is. So there really aren't limits on that side, but there are always going to be boxes with any of these tools, just because it's a structure, you know, it's a human structure that was created. I don't know if anyone could really claim that their way of doing it will cover all things. I don't think that's actually possible.
Right.
But I do think that there are ways of designing the infrastructure that lend itself to extensibility versus not. And so like one of those would be in Builder, every element type and every action type is actually a custom JavaScript function that you have access to in your project. So when you create a project, it's just our core. There's no JavaScript functions for like a conditional statement in there at all. That gets added to your project the first time you add a condition action into a flow, or the first time you add a chart element onto the page. That JavaScript gets put inside of your project. So that concept of we're treating everything like packages that are dependent and we bring everything into your project as you need it, and store it inside your project, right? So that way you can modify it if you want. Just conceptually thinking about, you know, this type of a tool in that way versus here's our list of actions, and every project gets that list of actions. It's just a conceptual or, you know, philosophical difference of how you think about it.
Right. That's interesting. Now, talking about the no-code and low-code space, obviously, we're early, so there's a lot of growth in the next coming years. But at the same time, in my opinion, I wanted to learn more about yours. I think that if there's a recession or things, the economy starts cooling down, there might be certain no-code and low-code platforms up for sale or for grabs. How do you see the space? Do you think it's already too fragmented? Do you think there are a lot of no-code and low-code tools popping up that will grow and get users? Do you think that there will be like 5 or 6 big no-code and low-code tools in the next years? What's your vision in terms of the space?
I mean, I think it's just like software in general, or SaaS in general, or you know, you can kind of take your pick of any niche as well. I think you have all those things. The market is everyone at the end of the day. So depending on how you define the term no code, it's like everyone is a customer potentially, right? So I think you have across that spectrum, you have the big players, you have players who sort of like are always competing to be a big player, but never get there. And then you have this like crop of smaller tools, which is, you know, if you kind of picture it as a pyramid, it's like giant base of smaller tools. And you can kind of see that in like, if you look at like marketing automation tools or, you know, things that help you write content, you know, which ChatGPT might be destroying all of those here soon.
Yeah,
but
finally.
All of, you know, you kind of see that same thing. There's like the HubSpot, you know, and then there's like 100 small ones that
the AppSumo, at least a thousand.
Yeah, exactly. There's like, I think it's the same thing here, and I think a niche no code product. At some point, the market is smart enough and is onto it enough to where it makes sense to niche into markets. Like, you could have a no code form builder specifically designed for the types of companies I used to sell to, right? For like home building and flooring companies, because you just have a bunch of templates that match their needs and you speak their language, they're going to buy from you. And so I think the industry is large enough to support basically all of the types, just like these other industries are. And I think consolidation will absolutely happen. I think you mentioned that as well. It's bound to happen more and more. We saw some of it last year, right? There were a couple of companies that got acquired.
Yeah.
And that'll continue, which I think is good for the space. You need people to be able to get exits so that other people enter the space and add to it, right? People need that allure of, I might become rich if I sell this, right? To get into it and put.
And at the same time, these platforms being bought by the big players is a good check mark of there's value in the space, there's money in the space, it's worth building something in the no-code space.
Absolutely. And I think it's also a sign of like, there will be people in those who don't continue to go with the new company that acquired them and go start the better product that they had in mind from the beginning that they didn't get to build, you know?
Not that they have money.
That's great. It's how it should be. So I think we'll start seeing a lot of that soon.
Yeah, that's great. Mark, thanks so much. Do you want something to finish the podcast?
No, I mean, just thank you. I really appreciate being interviewed and talking to you. It's been a good conversation, and I love and enjoy your takes on Twitter. And, you know, I think, I don't know how long we've known each other on Twitter, a long time. Probably 2 or 3 years or something. I don't know.
Probably.
A while, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for joining.